Welcome to All Sides. Ever since a man in Tunisia burned himself to death in December 2010 in protest, pro-democracy rebellions have erupted across the Middle East. By January, the Tunisian president had fled to Saudi Arabia. Protests started in Yemen and Egypt, and the Arab Spring was underway. Popular protests in Egypt have toppled a dictator, and Western powers, including the U.S., are bombing supporters in strongholds of Libya's dictator in support of an uprising there. But in Syria and Yemen, pro-democracy protests have been met with brutal government reprisals. Later, we're going to hear from a reporter for Al Jazeera English who recently returned from covering events in Egypt. Right now, we welcome Professor Richard Herman, the director of the Mershon Center for International Security Studies at OSU, for an update on the situation in the Middle East. And Rick, you said welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ann.
How do you even begin to start rounding up these things, particularly in limited amounts of time? It's like
well, it's very difficult, and they're very. I mean, there's some similarities across the various countries, but some of the ones you've mentioned here are really quite different. And a lot of it depends, I think, on how the state reacts to a popular demand for change. And we've seen the state react, obviously, very differently in Syria than it did in Egypt, and again, very differently in Libya than it did in Tunisia. And I think a lot of the future course of this is going to be as much a function of how these states adjust to demands for change as it is will be differences in terms of what people are demanding. I see a lot more similarity in that across all of these cases. I think we spend a lot of time. I think the grievances are really well known, and they've been there for 30 years. The catalyst that brings them to the fruition right now is hard to predict, but understanding what the motive forces underneath them are, we've been talking about for a long, long time.
That inspired people to rebel in the first place. So are they – but the catalyst or this Arab Spring that they're talking about, that's real. People are inspired by people in other countries to do this. How the governments react is what's the difference.
Yes, that's in my view. And I think the inspiration from it comes both because of demographic and population change as well as, you know, 30 years or more of constant leadership from people who are, you know, highly authoritarian.
If you have a question or comment for our guest, Richard Herman, he's director for international security studies at the Mershon Center for director at the Mershon Center for International Security Studies. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. There have been warrants filed against Colonel Gaddafi in Libya now. What's the process from the outside? What can the outside powers do to influence, even from the UN standpoint? What can they really do in NATO to make a change here, as it stands, without going into outright war?
Well, I think an attack on the country is outright war. I think they could do a lot. I think it just depends on how big a price they're willing to pay. I think NATO forces could topple Gaddafi. I mean, they could invade the country the way they did Iraq if they wanted to. They could back the opposition. Mohamed El-Wafrili is coming to Washington this week and asking for that kind of support. He's asking for increased military assistance to the resistance. I think it's a political decision on how far they want to go. I don't think it's too mysterious what they could do at the outer reaches of their capability. Obviously, they would not probably be able to get UN approval. They don't have strong UN approval for ousting Gaddafi, obviously. But that doesn't mean that it would stop them necessarily. It didn't stop the United States in Iraq from acting. I think politically, the tightrope they're trying to walk is to ensure that Gaddafi falls, but without making it look as if, which it will look as if, the NATO forces did it.
Senator Richard Lugar, the top Republican on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, said President Obama needs congressional approval by the end of the week on May 20th to continue U.S. involvement in the strikes in Libya under the 1973 War Powers Act. But Senator John McCain, top Republican on the Senate Armed Services Committee, says no president has ever recognized the constitutionality of the War Powers Act. What do you think is going to happen?
The War Powers Act does say you have 60 days to act. In defense of the country or whichever way you think you need to, and then you need authorization from the Congress. It's true, I think, that presidents haven't usually looked for a congressional declaration of war, but it's also unusual that the president hasn't consulted more with the Congress. It's sometimes that the president consults with the Congress and the United Nations. Other times they've consulted only with the Congress and not waited for United Nations approval. What's a little unusual here is that the president has consulted carefully with the United Nations and the NATO allies, and much less so with the U.S. Congress. And I can imagine people in the Congress now wanting to have more say over this. I don't think they'll disagree in the end with what President Obama has chosen to do. They may want to use even more force to bring this to a faster conclusion. Those kinds of things they can discuss. But I doubt there'll be a groundswell, even if he goes to Congress, for pulling out of Libya or stopping our involvement there.
614-292-8513. That's the number to call if you have a question or comment for our guest, Richard Herman. He is director at the Mershon Center for International Securities Studies. And Dee in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Yes. I heard once described late at night on the BBC a scene that took place in Tahrir Square in a tent with Muslims and at least one Christian, where they drew up a kind of charter. They called it the Egyptian birth certificate. This was in the first weeks of the uprising, and it was written on the bottom of a pallet of water from the cardboard from water bottles, and it was kind of like a charter or a constitution that they had drawn up of basic values. And it sounded like a cross between, like I said, a charter and maybe like a prototype of a constitution. And I've heard no reference to this story of this group in this tent or what became of this, if some of the ideas of that are indeed being transferred into the new Egyptian constitution. It's like the story just disappeared with the dawn. I wondered if Mr. Herman was aware of that or could speak to it.
I don't know that particular story. I saw a week ago the constitution that the Egyptian government is actually considering reforming and the various articles within it, and they're working on that. And there are parts to that constitution that is in play that I think raise lots of problems for them, in the sense that on the one hand they want to not privilege any particular subgroup within the country. At the same time, they want to recognize Sharia as a basis of law. There's problems in the Egyptian constitution if you're going to create a sort of a democratic liberal society in which people are equal. And they're wrestling with that hard right now. Whether there were groups outside of the current groups that are talking about this that wrote up things in the midst of Tahrir Square, I just don't know. Maybe our guest from Al Jazeera does, but I'm not sure.
Coming up later, Leila Al-Aryan will be joining us from Al Jazeera English. She's in town, and we'll be talking to her coming up in a little while. Dee, maybe we can cover that then, okay?
Thank you.
Thanks, Dee. Omar and Powell, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes. Actually, I have a comment, which is also a question as well.
Okay.
Dr. Herman, we've been told for decades, you know, in pop culture and the media, there's an image about Arabs and Muslims that are really being violent, and their history is really full with violence, and the only thing they understand is violence. And suddenly we have another extreme that really been presented to us, you know, that these peaceful demonstrations that we've been seeing in country like Egypt with 80 million people, totally peaceful. Do you think there will be a time when we could reexamine and evaluate all these misleading information that we have in our media about 350 million people in the Middle East?
I certainly hope so. I agree with you that there is that popular perception. I also agree with you that it's very wide from the mark and not based on a lot of reality. Nevertheless, the United States has been at war in Iraq now for 6 or 8 years. There's been a war on terrorism for now more than a decade. And so I think in the popular mind, there are Arabs who dislike Americans and even want to kill them. And from that, they generalize to the broader Arab world. I think and I hope, as I infer from your question, that this Arab Spring will go a long ways in changing that. They'll realize or see, it's hard to miss it, that there are tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of Arabs willing to come into the street in some cities and demand political change, end of authoritarianism. You know, 10 years ago or 15, it was all about a clash of civilizations, as if the Muslim culture was incompatible with democracy and people there were comfortable with authoritarianism forever. It was sort of imbued in Islam. I think everything we're seeing here, I hope, will give some lie to that in the American mind and show that it wasn't true then, it's not true now. What the problems there have been in my view, are highly authoritarian governments, a lack of individual freedom, a lack of economic progress and development, any kind of normal and fair-minded distribution of resources and wealth across the populations, as well as a very rapidly growing younger population that's actually plugged into the rest of the world and is more and more frustrated because they can see the differences between what they're able to experience in, say, someplace like Egypt and what they would be capable of doing if they were living in Italy or somewhere else around the world. And I think as we're seeing some of the leaders of the resistance currently in Libya, Mohammed El-Wafari, I went to graduate school with him.
Oh.
These people are well-educated in the West. I mean, they've known us, and they've known us for a long time, and they've been very successful business people around the world, and they're just simply fed up, in my view, with really bad leadership and stupid leaders. And in Gaddafi's case, a man who many people think is not only been in power too long, but is not entirely mentally balanced.
Last week, a scholar from George Mason University made the assertion that, you know, someone mentioned someone who's educated in the West automatically is going to be, why aren't they, the leaders, Assad. Assad's wife was educated in the West. He was educated in the West. Why does he treat his people like this? And the scholar from George Mason said, being educated in the West has absolutely no bearing on whether somebody, embraces democracy, embraces liberal democracy and that sort of thing.
Could be true. All I meant is that they're educated. They know a lot. They've experienced the world. They understand what's going on in business and economic and global circles. I suppose some who are educated in the West become Democrats, and some have a democratic youth when they're here, and as soon as they go home, they're socialized back into the political realities of their state. That's been in my entire career. I knew many young Iranians when I was in graduate school in the 70s who were ferociously anti-government, but when they went home, they accommodated to reality. They really had very few choices.
And likewise, people who are never educated in the West, who never have that benefit, they still can embrace democracy. And
I think the strongest voices for political reform and change in much of Egypt for the last several decades have been people in the Muslim Brotherhood. Many of them as jurists and actually sharing the prisons with more secular-minded liberal human rights types. And where they could find common cause was in the demand for reform and change. In Tunisia, Rashid Ghannouchi has been pushing for moderate reform and some sort of political development towards at least democratic and more liberal space because it would benefit them. We could have argued that it was just expedient, but many of the more conservative Islamic groups have been pushing for this for decades because it would open up the political space for themselves as well as others.
Omar, thank you for your call.
Thank you.
This is All Sides with Dan Fisher. My guest, Rick Herman, director of Mershon Center for International Security Studies. This is 89.7 NPR News.
This is 89.7 NPR News. In 1961, segregation seemed to have an overwhelming grip on American society. That is, until an integrated band of college students decided to risk everything and buy a ticket on a Greyhound bus bound for the Deep South. They called themselves the Freedom Riders, and they managed to bring the president and the entire American public face to face with the challenge of correcting civil rights inequities that plagued the nation. Watch as American Experience presents Freedom Riders tonight at 9 on WOSU-TV.
Support for 89.7 comes from Westfield Insurance, exclusive sponsor of In the Know, where Bexley meets Dublin Scioto in this season's final match on Friday at 8 p.m. on WOSU+. Westfield Insurance, sharing knowledge, building trust.
And it's 47 degrees in downtown Columbus. Light rain today, cloudy skies, and a high right around 50 degrees. A chance of rain tonight and a low of 43. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides. My guest, Richard Herman. He's director for the Mershon Center for International Security Studies. And joining us now is Leila Al-Aryan. She is a writer and producer for Al Jazeera English in Washington, D.C., where she has most recently been instrumental in the network's coverage of the popular uprisings in North Africa and the Middle East and the release of the Palestine Papers. Leila is the co-author of Collateral Damage, America's War Against Iraqi Civilians. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So tell us, what do you find over there as a reporter covering it directly?
Well, I was in Egypt during the revolution. In fact, during the most dangerous and frankly terrifying time of the revolution, which is the day when the Egyptian security forces sent in hundreds, if not thousands, of people, many of them paid supporters of the Mubarak regime, to attack the peaceful protesters in Tahrir Square. They came on horseback, on camelback, carrying weapons and pelting massive rocks onto the demonstrators in the square. So it is, and Egypt turned out to actually be one of the safest and least dangerous places to cover during these tumultuous times. To be a journalist in Libya is a very frightening thing. You just mentioned the book I co-wrote with Chris Hedges, Collateral Damage. The photograph that's on the front of the book was taken by a very talented photojournalist by the name of Chris Hondros, who passed away in Libya a few weeks ago.
With Tim Hetherington, another photographer.
Very tragically. So it's a very dangerous time right now for journalists covering the region. One of my colleagues, Dorothy Parvez, was detained upon entering Syria. We're not sure where she is now. She's been gone for more than 15 days. So journalists are under attack many times because of their affiliation with Al Jazeera. When I was in Egypt, I felt that my colleagues and I were actually being hunted down by the security forces, who were going from hotel to hotel, conducting sweeps, looking for any signs of people being a journalist. I felt like even the wait staff at the hotels were all affiliated with the government, and that basically there was surveillance all around. And the situation is the same in Bahrain, where it's very difficult to report, as well as Syria, which is no longer allowing journalists into its borders. It's difficult to cover these events with sort of a semblance of freedom and difficult to kind of ensure one's own safety.
Yes, and so I suppose as consumers of, you know, what you provide and what the rest of the journalists are out there providing, how do we know? What should we be doing as consumers of it to make sure we're getting the best information?
Well, I think just following the outlets that you trust. I think Al Jazeera has been praised in the last few months, especially for its coverage of the Arab Spring. It's devoted enormous resources into covering these historic events, and it's paid a price. One of our cameramen was actually killed in Libya. And he was targeted. He was shot in the back.
It wasn't by accident.
It wasn't by accident. It's also trying to seek out. I mean, I think one of the advantages of these times where we're so, you know, it's so easy to kind of access people across the world, you know, whether it's on Twitter or, you know, various blogs, is to just kind of try to hear the testimony from the people themselves who are testifying to what they're doing and, to their protests and their movements. So just seeking out those authentic voices, I think, also helps.
And on the same token, in Libya, it's hard to find a representative voice for the rebels. And they seem to have a spokesman now, at least one or two that are official spokesmen. Who do you go to? Where do you go to figure out who's in charge?
It's a very complicated situation, especially because it's fluid and constantly changing. But I think one should definitely apply a healthy dose of skepticism to people who kind of are self-appointed spokespeople, and just really looking at their backgrounds, who they are, what motivates them, and how popular they are within, the protest movement and within people who are fighting for their freedom.
This is Leila Al-Aryan. She is going to speak tonight at Saxby Auditorium on the Moritz College of Law at Ohio State University. For more information, you can go to WOSU.org/allsides and get information about that at a link. If you have a question or comment for Leila or for Rick Herman, director of the Mershon Center for International Security Studies, give us a call, 614-292-8513. And Susie in Worthington, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Oh, hi, Ann. And, Leila, such an honor to speak with you, and I wondered if you could speak about the illegal Israeli siege of Gaza and the fact that the U.S. contributes $3 to $10 billion of years for the illegal Israeli occupation and the cruel siege, and the fact that many people, including Alice Walker, have likened the Gaza flotilla to the freedom rides that Anne's going to be talking about later.
Leila,
thanks for your question. Well, Gaza has been under siege since the Palestinian political faction Hamas took power in the Gaza Strip, and they were elected in 2006, and the siege was imposed shortly thereafter by Israel and the United States and the European Union sort of collectively. And essentially, there are major restrictions as far as what can enter Gaza, from building materials, which are critical to rebuild the tiny strip's infrastructure after the 2008-2009 war, to many times medical supplies and kind of, you know, food and sort of essential staples. Now, since the Egyptian government fell on February 11th, the situation is changing somewhat, where the Egyptians are easing some of the controls on the border between the Gaza Strip and Egypt. So many people are hopeful that there will be some change as far as the suffocation and the strangulation that the Gaza Strip has endured for the past several years and the humanitarian crisis that that's caused.
Thank you, Susie, for that call. From a listener, we have an email. They write, yesterday on a Sunday morning public affairs show, a very knowledgeable guest, himself an Arab, said that the term Arab Spring is unfortunate and misleading. He said that it gives the impression that what has come about this spring has had long historic roots and that it will take years to finally work out in terms of what types of governments and societies finally emerge in the various Arab countries. Comments?
I mean, I tend to be averse to any kind of, you know, term that almost sounds like it's, you know, randomly imposed. I think maybe more telling is, you know, the Arab revolutions or Arab awakening has been one that's been used. I think, you know, more important than semantics is actually making distinctions between the various countries because they are very different. I think with the case of Egypt and Tunisia, you had a situation where the governments, while they did fight back, they didn't use all the weaponry at their disposal, partly because the military took a very important stance and refused to fight against their own people in Egypt and Tunisia. So, and also the role of sort of outside powers who eventually, although it came a bit late, supported the people's power. In the cases of Libya, Bahrain, Syria, you have it's a lot more complicated. You have some sectarian and ethnic tensions in Yemen as well. You have, specifically the case of Bahrain, a U.S. You know, stance that's been timid at best, supportive of the Bahraini government at worst. Just recently, two State Department officials who are, you know, tasked with looking over the Middle East refused to testify on the Hill about into an investigation on Bahraini human rights abuses. So, you know, it's important to kind of look at all these countries distinctly, as well as obviously acknowledging that they're all inspired by each other's example, but also looking at what makes them different and trying to understand that more in depth.
Rick, any thoughts about that Arab Spring or Arab Awakening? It's great for broadcast media, but
sure.
Is it?
Well, the label doesn't bother me one way or the other because it is simply a broadcast shorthand so people can capture this broad and complicated phenomenon. If the person writing that is discouraged that it may be some time before these things work themselves out, I think he's just going to be discouraged. I think that the change, for example, that's occurred in Egypt isn't done, and not by a long, long way. The military regime that has ruled in that country for a long time still rules there. I mean, they threw over the top guy, possibly to save themselves. The rest of the reform is yet to be accomplished, and the military still rules for the most part. And the change we'll see when we get to the fall elections, just how deep and thoroughgoing it actually is. Same in Tunisia. There's a long way to go. In Libya, as we've been talking about already, I mean, it's hard to predict. As I say, I mean, external powers could come in and decisively shift the balance. But right now, they're fighting to what looks like a long-term stalemate. It could go on for who knows how long, and it's very bloody, as Layla has been saying. So I don't find that a very acceptable outcome. In Syria, we don't know yet. I mean, the regime is far from cracked. I listen to the dissidents every day. They think Assad's days are numbered, but people said that a year and a half ago about the regime in Iran, which faced a much bigger public protest, a much stronger green movement to try to oust Ahmadinejad. And, you know, the regimes have a way of pushing back and pushing back hard, and it's not clear to me which way it will go in Syria in the long run. As Layla said, in Bahrain, it's different again because it has strong allies in the region. It has allies, obviously, of Saudi Arabia, which sent in its forces to protect Bahrain. It actually gets a lighter touch from Al Jazeera and other places where, you know, other regimes in the Gulf that are sensitive to political change in the Gulf, which has not happened in any of the Gulf states yet. So I think these cases get very complicated quickly, and what we've seen is an explosion of desire for change. And the first time in my lifetime, actual Arabs willing to come into the street and fight for it, demand it in mass. Some of it may be possible because of the younger cohort, maybe because of the social media that allows it to organize differently. Who knows exactly? I think we'll be writing books about why at this moment in 2011 it became possible when in 30 previous years it wasn't possible or it never occurred. I don't know the answers to that. I just know it's occurring in very different ways across different parts of the Middle East.
Layla, what is your impression about the impact of social media? It seemed to may have a big impact in Egypt, but it's not having the same effect. Certainly in Syria and Libya, they pretty much cut it all off right from the beginning.
Right. Well, as you've said, in Egypt, it definitely had a tremendous impact.
And although, in Iran, of course, Iran, last summer.
There was actually a sign that someone was carrying in Tahrir Square that said, "Thank you to the Facebook generation and the Twitter generation." But I think the difference is that in order to kind of stem that tide of internet activism, the other governments employed such harsh and brutal tactics very early on, sending in tanks right away, bombing their own people. I mean, in Syria, since March, there have been an estimated over 800 people killed. I mean, that's similar to the estimate of people killed during the entire Egyptian revolution. So, you know, really, just very brutal tactics to suppress whatever, you know.
They're trying to hunt people down, too. They're going through the houses, just pulling people out of their houses now.
Exactly. And in Bahrain, you see people, doctors and medical personnel, you know, almost 50 of them being detained and threatened with trial for basically doing their jobs and for documenting, you know, the attacks against the protesters. So you see, you know, a much more sort of systemic targeting of the activists in all these different countries. And I think in that way, it's kind of the sort of internet and the internet's role has subsided. And people are sort of resorting to more traditional tactics.
Speaking of the military, in Libya, there have been spotty reports of the military helping the rebels, but the military in and of itself in Libya is very weak to begin with, right? So
it was always small, about 50,000 forces, a lot of it bought in sub-Saharan mercenaries, some of it around Gaddafi's family and his tribe in the local areas where he has had popularity and continues to buy support. On the rebel side, or I don't know really what to call them at this point. I mean, sure, there have been a number of very important defections. But as Layla said, it's not a well-organized opposition. They don't have trained forces to come in and fight. They're just learning how. This is not a big army. It's not a powerful army. But even a small, well-paid mercenary army can do a lot when it's up against unarmed citizens who aren't used to military engagements and fighting, and particularly if they don't have any weapons.
Ken in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'd like to go over about Gaza. Israel, my understanding is Israel has no troops in Gaza. They pulled out of Gaza completely. In response to them pulling out completely was Hamas started sending rockets, large amount of rockets into Israel. Thousands of rockets have been fired onto Israel from Gaza after Israel pulled everyone out, including settlements. Everyone was pulled out of Gaza. And so the blockade that has come about is to stop weapons from coming into Gaza from Iran and to protect the Israeli citizens. I'd like to get your guest comment on that.
Leila? Thank you, Ken.
I think that a couple of points. If the blockade is just about weapons, then why is medicine banned? You know, why are a lot of food items banned? So I think that answers that. And also the question would be, as a civilized society and one that believes in the principles of human rights, do we believe that a policy of collective punishment is one that's just and one that we would, you know, ourselves impose on people, or is it something that we should condemn and speak out against?
Ken?
It's supported by Hamas. That's the government of Gaza.
So do you believe in the collective punishment of the people of Gaza?
Oops, I guess we lost him. Thanks for that call. Tom in Circleville, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me on. My question is, how does your young lady and the people of the Middle East feel about Bahrain and the UAE meeting with the founder of Blackwater? And they're talking about starting an 800-man foreign army, in other words, and I hate to say it because I'm American mercenaries over in the Middle East.
Or at least run by an American company.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Meeting with leaders in Bahrain and the United Arab Emirates. Leila?
Well, I read this report yesterday. I hadn't heard about Bahrain, but I definitely heard that Eric Prince, who now lives in Abu Dhabi, in order to avoid some of the lawsuits that have been filed against him by
Blackwater,
mm-hmm. Now called Z, by his former employees. He's been living in the UAE for some time now, and the report basically said that he's been approached by one of the UAE rulers to form a militia to protect the ruler, and that he's brought in some Colombians as mercenaries who came in sort of under the cover of construction workers or some other kinds of workers. Obviously, it's very disturbing. I mean, on the one hand, it's not an old tactic. I mean, historically, rulers have sort of brought in militias for their own protection. And I think the UAE is looking around the region and seeing what's happening to many of its allies, and they're obviously afraid. But, you know, Blackwater has a lot of blood on its hands and a lot of blood of you know, people, Arabs and Muslims on its hands. And its founder, Eric Prince, has made some very disturbing comments about how he views himself as a Christian crusader. And, you know, the article that I read ended with a statement about how he said, don't hire any Muslims for this militia. Don't hire any Muslim mercenaries because they would refuse to kill their fellow Muslims. So that kind of gives you some insight into how Eric Prince thinks. And, you know, by all means, it's a very disturbing report and one that I think people should really be talking about and questioning.
Thank you, Tom. We have an email from Paul. Paul writes, Turkey seems to have achieved a remarkable level of success in balancing social, religious, and cultural issues while maintaining a level of prosperity, stability, and freedom for its citizens and a good relationship with both West and Eastern neighbors. Would a Turkish model of government work for these nations, and how likely would new leaderships be to adopt a Turkish model? Or maybe there's the final question, is there any model out there?
Well, I'd like to take a stab at it and then maybe defer to the professor because I'm sure he would have a lot more to offer. But just from what I know about Turkey, there are still major restrictions on religious freedom, on, you know, wearing of the headscarf in public places. So that seems like they've taken sort of the secularism to an extreme in the sense that it restricts what we Americans value in terms of religious freedom and really being able to dress how we want. So as an American Muslim, I was able to attend university wearing a headscarf, but if I lived in Turkey, that wouldn't have been possible for me. So, you know, I value sort of the American model, and as far as at least balancing religious freedom and, you know, secular values and all of that.
Rick Herman?
My liberal friends who teach at the various universities in Turkey are often unhappy with the Islamic movements in Turkey, and they don't like them any more than many liberal Americans like the far Christian right in the United States. And they often challenge me, asking me how comfortable I would be if the far Christian right took power and, you know, liberal Americans had to accommodate to their social norms. So I don't, but my bigger point is not about Turkey. I think these other countries are all different. I agree very much with something Layla said earlier, and that they're not, it's not going to be one size fits all here. I think the history of Egypt is just very different than the history of Libya. I think Bahrain is a completely different kind of place. The sectarian differences, for example, in Bahrain are very different. You know, a minority rules. It's even a smaller minority that rules in Syria, very small. Sectarian minority has ruled in Syria now for four decades, that lives with a military that's rooted in the strength of Alawite and Christians, exactly afraid that a majority Sunni Muslim population could turn against them. There are all kinds of intermarriages over the last 20, 30 years among Alawite and Sunni merchants to try to bridge these possible sectarian differences. But if Syria blows up, these sectarian divides, just like we saw in Iraq, can come back in very deep form. Even though in Iraq previously they had been in many ways papered over or at least reduced. So when we look for models of government in countries that are as ethnically diverse as Iraq, as socially and ethnically and religiously as diverse as Syria, and then think about what we're going to do in Egypt or in Bahrain, I think we have very different models here and different. And we know a lot about this in political science, about how best to set up kind of representative systems when you have different kinds of concerns, small minorities that are fearful and want to be protected versus, you know, very majorities that want to have control. So I think if you're talking about the balance between Islam and secularism, I think, frankly, maybe in the American mind, that's been too driven in by the last 8 or 9 years focus on Al-Qaeda and the demonization of radical Islam, as they call it here, and that this is the great threat to us in the Middle East. I don't think it is. I think there are going to be very serious religious leaders who have credibility in their society precisely because they are seen as devout in many ways. As I mentioned earlier, I think many Muslim brothers have that status in Egypt. Rashi Ghannouchi surely has it in Tunisia. And it's not because they're radical. It's more as if I can make some kind of analogy to the American system, people who in the United States have reputation as decent people, the way President Carter did when I was in graduate school, and not because he's a religious fundamentalist, but because he has devout religious views, and that sense of what was right guided him in how he behaved politically. And I think that gives these people some moral strength and stature, and some of them are going to be part of the system for sure.
That's Dr. Richard Herman, Director of Mershon Center for International Security Studies. Rick, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
And also Layla Al-Aryan. She is going to be speaking tonight in a panel discussion, North Africa and Middle East Popular Revolutions. Is now the time for people's power? You can go learn more about that at WOSU.org/allsides. Layla is a writer and producer for Al Jazeera English in Washington, D.C. Thanks so much for joining us today, Layla.
Thank you.
This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. On Fresh Air, you'll hear the questions you wish you could have asked to people like Tom Kenny, the voice of SpongeBob SquarePants.
Did it help to hear what your voice sounded like on helium? Did you learn something about your voice you didn't know before?
Yeah, I learned that I don't really need the helium.
Because it's pretty easy to flick that switch and go right up there.
The most interesting people in show business on Fresh Air.
And Fresh Air begins at noon in just about 15 minutes on today's Fresh Air, an investigative series, The Radiation Boom, about how new radiation medical therapies have created new cures, but have also created new ways to do harm. Join us for that discussion on Fresh Air on 89.7 NPR News.
Support for 89.7 comes from the Central Ohio Trauma System, working with community partners to make Central Ohio a safer place to live. Details about joining the Columbus Medical Association Foundation and supporting the Central Ohio Trauma System are at goodhealthcolumbus.org.
And tonight, Watch's American Experience presents the story of a band of college students who risked everything to bring the American public face-to-face with civil rights issues. Watch Freedom Riders tonight at 9 on WOSU-TV. 47 degrees in downtown Columbus. There's a chance of rain today and a high near 50. Also a chance of rain tonight, a low of 43. Showers are likely for Tuesday, a high of 53 degrees, and more rain for Wednesday, a high of 62. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides. In the era of Jim Crow, African Americans traveling in the South were forced to sit in the back of the bus or train and use separate waiting rooms, drinking fountains, and restrooms. Infractions exacerbated the always present threat of violence. Today, we're going to talk with Lorenz Grant. She's the producer of the documentary Freedom Riders, which tells the story of the courageous, nonviolent civil rights activists who dared to defy the laws of Jim Crow in the Deep South in 1961. Freedom Riders airs tonight on American Experience on WOSU-TV at 9 p.m. Welcome, Lorenz.
Thank you so much.
Also joining us is Charles David Myers. David was a student at Central State College in Wilberforce, Ohio, when, with fellow students, he joined the Freedom Riders. Welcome, David.
Thank you.
And again, I wanted to say Central State University, but it is was Central State College at the time.
Yes, it became a university in 1965.
Let's listen to James Farmer. He was the national director of the Congress of Racial Equality. He was the man who announced the beginning of the Freedom Riders challenge to racial segregation on buses in the South. Let's listen to him in this scene from the documentary.
On May 4th, 1961, 13 of us, Negroes and whites, bought tickets in Washington, D.C. for a long ride on two regularly scheduled buses through the Deep South. Others said we should wait for the time to get ripe, for things to cool off. But we believe the time is always ripe to fight evil.
Lorenz, the Freedom Riders' nonviolent direct action was a new strategy at the time. How did it differ from previous efforts to attain equal rights for African Americans, and why did it happen in 61?
Well, there was a growing movement, and of course, David could expound more clearly on this, but the Freedom Riders were trained by individuals who were really steeped in the Gandhian philosophy of nonviolence. And there was an attempt to do a type of a Freedom Ride in 1947, but that focused mainly on the Upper South. And so the main difference with the 1961 Freedom Riders is with all the laws that had been passed, you know, in terms of students and youth movement and, you know, their patience had just worn thin. Everything had been passed as far as they were concerned. You know, the Supreme Court was on their side. You know, Brown v. Board of Education had been passed, and they were saying, you know, enough is enough. We do not want to ride in the back of the bus, and we want to sort of really challenge in a nonviolent way this societal structure that really was more based on culture and custom. So that's really what set them off.
David, Central State College, now, as I mentioned earlier, called Central State University, is a historically black college, so student involvement from there seems natural. You're not African American. How did you hear about the Freedom Rides, and why did you decide to join the movement?
Well, I had followed it in the newspaper since CORE, the organization founded by Jim Farmer, mm-hmm. First announced that they were going to hold this event, and I followed it until the 24th of May, and that was the day of the first arrest in Jackson, Mississippi. And another student in Central State and I decided that we wanted to be a part of it. And one of the things that I thought about in the civil rights movement from the time I went to Central State was that everyone was saying we need to wait and let these things work out naturally, that they'll take care of themselves in time. But I had several friends that I had made there on the campus, the faculty and staff and others who were in their 60s and 70s, and they didn't have time to wait. I wanted them to experience that freedom before their time ran out.
Did anyone try to talk you out of it?
My mother tried to talk me out of it, as I think most mothers would. But I was at home with her on the day the bus was burned in Anniston, Alabama, and we watched it on TV together. And she told me later that she could see in my eyes at that time that I was going to be doing that.
She knew her son. Lorenz, the Freedom Riders adhered to the moral principle and political strategy of nonviolence. They actually were trained in nonviolence before they were allowed to join the protests. Why was that necessary, and what was the training like?
The training was really incredible from my point of view as a filmmaker, since I, of course, was not there and didn't experience it, but it was incredible and riveting. It was really sort of a bare-bones procedure of this is what could happen if you are, you know, someone calls you a name, or you're literally attacked, or puts cigarettes on you, or pushes you, or literally how to react by not reacting. And there was, you know, even discussions on, you know, men and women, you know, should men and women go, and how should men and women behave. And so really the training was, since certainly, you know, social mores with men and women were slightly different than today, it was if a woman wants to go and she wants to put herself in that danger, then that is certainly her right, but her training would be similar. So it's really astounding how they were trained, and I think it really helped, because certainly if someone is going to hit you or strike at you, you know, there may be a natural human reaction to fight back, to defend yourself. But it was really a brilliant strategy, because if they were attacked, which they certainly didn't know to what extent would happen, the media would pick up on this, and you would see, you know, a poised person, black or white, male or female, literally being set upon by what would look like an angry mob. So it kind of strikes at the moral fabric of the society of, goodness, should we allow this to continue? You know, they're just sitting at a lunch counter. They're just in a bus, sitting in a seat, and they're, you know, literally almost killed for that. So that really was the emphasis and the basis behind the strategy.
David, did the training help? How hard was it to remain nonviolent in the face of just not threats of violence, but actual violence?
Well, some of us didn't have that training. There were eventually five of us from Central State arrested. Three of us were male, and there were two female. And at least two, the one I was arrested with and myself, were conscientious objectors to the military draft, and we were confirmed pacifists. And that was one reason that I went without training. And the other thing was that I felt that there's no way you can win being violent. First of all, you try to be violent against the mob, and you don't have a chance. That just increases your chances of being injured or killed.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing is the strategy works out much more in your favor if you don't fight back.
The Freedom Riders used group singing to give them strength in their nonviolent struggle. In this scene from the documentary, Joan Mulholland and Bernard Lafayette Jr. explain how singing helped them even when they were serving time in prison.
But if they wanted to stop our singing or control our behavior, they would take the mattresses.
Let me say it. You can take our mattress, oh yes. You can take our mattress, oh yes. We start piling up the mattress at the door so they wouldn't have any problem. So they, you know, we were with the program. We were going to still sing. And we continued to sing.
In another scene from the film, Ernest Patton Jr. explains how in prison the men would sing at night and the women would sing back so they knew everyone was all right. David, do you remember what singing meant to you in the face of violence? And David, I know your wife, Margaret, you weren't married at the time, but she has a very different story and spent a lot more time in prison.
Yes, she's sitting here right next to me.
Oh, hello, Margaret.
Hello.
I didn't know you were going to be with us. Thanks for joining us. Well, tell us what the music meant to you as members of the Freedom Riders.
Oh, the singing was very important. There was a lot of joking and a lot of singing, and it kept our spirits up and gave us strength, and it was beautiful.
David, what about you? You were in a jail. Margaret ended up in prison.
I spent most of my time in the Jackson City Jail and only a few days at the penitentiary. Winona spent more than 3 months there at the penitentiary. But I was in a group of all white men, And I don't think we sang as much as the people did across the street, where all of the women were kept and the black men were kept in the Hinds County Jail. We were in the Jackson City Jail. We sang some, but it wasn't nearly as much a part of our daily life as it was across the street.
What about you, Margaret?
Oh, I can't. There were so many songs, and I've seen the movie, and many of the songs that we sang were not in the movie, but they were certainly inspiring. One I can think of, "Listen Here, Barnett, and Listen What I Say. There used to be discrimination, but it ends today. You better leave the new Negro alone." That was one of them. It was essential and basic and riveting.
You spent several months in prison, in the penitentiary, because you didn't want to pay the bail or the fines.
Correct. And also, I was, when we were moved to Parchman, I was situated in the first cell on the block, and so I was privy to all of the comings and goings, and I started to feel like a pulse of what was going on. The people had to remain 6 weeks. If they remained longer than 6 weeks, they could not appeal their case, and they were wanting to appeal. But there were more than 100 appeals in the works, and I decided that I also was able to listen to the guards joking and talking with one another, and they were saying, "Yeah, well, she'll be gone in 2 weeks," and it all became kind of like a supermarket kind of thing and a joke, and I just felt that there ought to be some little historical footnote that we're sitting down next to a fellow student in a public train station, it would cost you this much. And if nobody stayed for the length of the time, there was no evidence of the cost. Also, I didn't want to give Mississippi any money. I didn't pay bail. I didn't pay court costs. I didn't pay bail again. And they had to feed and clothe and house and guard me for all the time they kept me there.
Lorenz Grant, what do you hope the viewers get out of this tonight?
I hope they get a sense of unity, and also that it just takes, you know, average people to make a very bold statement. I think a lot of particularly, you know, younger kids and history, you know, they open the history books and think everybody is sort of born an icon and born doing amazing things. And really, it just starts with a brave few. And I think the Freedom Riders really proves that. We try to put together the whole spirit and the feeling of the movement, as well as that time period being in that capsule, and as well as just telling the story of what they did. I mean, it was just tremendous. It's like, for us, it was a riveting thriller, and we hope to try and bring the storytelling to that level as well.
That's Lorenz Grant. She's the producer of Freedom Riders, the first feature-length documentary to tell the story of the band of civil rights activists who called themselves the Freedom Riders and dared to defy the laws of Jim Crow in the Deep South in 1961. That's on PBS tonight at 9 p.m. Lorenz, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much, and great to speak with you guys again, David, Margaret.
And David and Margaret Myers, they married in 1962 and celebrated their 49th anniversary this year. David and Margaret, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
This is All Sides. This is WOSU 89.7, WOSU HD1, and WOSU 820 Columbus, and streaming online at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News, a service of WOSU Public Media.
From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Radiation treatment, x-rays, CT scans saves thousands of lives. but errors in dosage or problems with equipment or inadequately trained staff can create serious medical problems. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with New York Times investigative journalist Walt Bogdanich about his series documenting such mistakes. Part of the problem of detecting and reporting radiation errors, he says, is that symptoms may not arise for weeks or even years and are often difficult to identify.
When there's a botched surgery, you notice it right away. When there are bad drugs that are causing serious harm, you pretty much know it. But with radiation, there wasn't that ability to quickly identify the reason that perhaps skin was reddening.
Also, rock historian Ed Ward listens back to Neil Diamond's earliest songs. That's coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.